Now for the sermon, our pastor, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Horchak. Billy Graham was right. When I came to the Church of God at 17 years of age, other preachers at that time were categorized oftentimes by the church and maybe even Billy Graham as being a false minister. In the time since the church has matured, I think most members would regard Billy Graham, what they know of him, as a very fine man. And his son, Franklin Graham, as a very fine man, as you're able to see their fruits. Today, we probably wouldn't call them false ministers of Jesus Christ. We would acknowledge that they have probably done a lot of good in a world. And in fact, many years ago, Billy Graham paid a very high compliment to Herbert Armstrong. I don't know if this story was shared outside of the Brickett Wood congregation, but Mr. Armstrong related it. I can't remember if it was either during a Bible study or a Sabbath service. He was in England a lot during those years in the early 70s. So this would have happened in 1972 or 73 is my best guess to that. But the college in England was a customer of Harrod's department store in London, which at the time was the world's largest or one or two largest department stores in the entire world. And we bought a lot of stuff from Harrod's department store. Hope we got a good price because their stuff was pretty expensive. I'm sure that we did. Bought a lot of furniture. I think the International Lounge, where you and I spent many a evening and Saturday afternoon in the men's dormitory, was furnished from Harrod's department store. The manager of Harrod's department store thought this would be a really good idea to get Herbert Armstrong and Billy Graham together. So at one time, prior to Mr. Armstrong relating this story to us in the early 70s, the department manager of Harrod's department store in London arranged a phone call between Billy Graham and Herbert Armstrong. Now, of course, Billy Graham was the most famous of the two, and he was a very famous personality. I think in reviewing his life, most people would say that was a good man, a very good man. And I would say the same thing about his son, Franklin, from what I know of him. Maybe not all religious figures could you say the same thing of, but I'm pretty certain we would agree that that was the case. On this phone call that was arranged between the two men, you could say men of faith, Billy Graham paid a very high compliment to Brother Armstrong, as he called him. And he praised his ministry of Bible prophecy. Now, it's very interesting for those of us that came into the church during those years and heard many telecasts and read much of the work of Herbert Armstrong when we came into the church, that he would isolate that one area of Herbert Armstrong's speciality. But indeed, it was true that Herbert Armstrong had a gift for Bible prophecy. And as a result, Worldwide Church of God had a gift for Bible prophecy. And Billy Graham hit upon a truth about the Church of God that separated it from other religious organizations. He correctly identified Herbert Armstrong as standing alone in the 20th century in speaking about Bible prophecy. And as I say, it's interesting that he hit upon the uniqueness of this and what separated Worldwide Church of God for much of the 20th century from virtually all religious organizations. Certainly, Herbert Armstrong spoke about a lot of different things in his radio broadcasts. I don't know how Billy Graham came upon the information, except to say that he probably listened a few times or read some of the articles that Herbert Armstrong had written, because Mr. Armstrong spoke about a lot of different topics, not just Bible prophecy. In 1971, before I began attending the Church of God, in the summer of 1971, maybe close to this time of the year, about 50 years ago, I remember my brother Hugh had introduced us to the teachings of the church, which we all initially rejected. But my interest was piqued to some extent because I remember standing in the kitchen and asking Mom, does anybody else believe that Jesus will return to earth? Because that's what my brother was telling me. That's what his church was telling him. For those of you that don't know, and those of you that have grown up in an age where maybe there's a lot more information about Bible prophecy, I can tell you that my mother and I kind of puzzled over this because this was a revelation to us. We had never heard anyone teaching about the return of Jesus Christ to this earth or to rule on this earth. I had gone to the Lutheran church. My parents had taken us to the Lutheran church, as I've mentioned to you before. But we had never heard of this teaching or this doctrine. We were taught about Christ and his ministry and certain things about the ministry of Martin Luther, mostly. But we had never heard, and we had never heard of a church that taught that Jesus Christ was coming back to earth. And I don't think that our experience outside of the Church of God was necessarily unique in American mainstream culture and religion, because it wasn't actively taught. Now today, and since the time that many of us came to the Church of God, there have been many other voices out there talking about Bible prophecy. Hal Lindsey is an author and a minister you might have heard of. And in 1969, he wrote a book about Bible prophecy, a lot of it that we would regard as not being accurate according to the Bible, but nonetheless, it was a book about Bible prophecy called The Late Great Planet Earth. That was in 1969, and it became a bestseller. But many decades before that, Herbert Armstrong and Worldwide Church of God, and then before that, Radio Church of God, had boldly proclaimed the message of Bible prophecy and Jesus Christ's eventual return to earth. But no one else was talking about it. Not in this country and not anywhere else. And I tell you the story so that you'll understand the times in which many of us who came into the church in the 50s, 60s, 70s, the type of atmosphere culturally that we were growing up in. From the noted authority Wikipedia, it says, Lindsey's claims are based on a dispensationalist interpretation of the Old and New Testament. Lindsey claims from the Bible that Jesus Christ will return from heaven to earth someday and establish eternal peace and a harmony among all people. Lindsey says the Bible contains numerous prophecies that foretell of certain conditions and events that will occur in the world prior to Christ's return. That was what Lindsey taught, beginning with his publication of his first book in the late 60s. But the Church of God, Worldwide Church of God, Radio Church of God before that, was the leader in teaching Bible prophecy. The approach wasn't perfect, and I'll cite that in just a moment. But that imperfection may have taken a toll to some degree, and it may have repeated a history of about 100 years earlier than that. And I'll get into that in a bit. But How has the Church of God been able to maintain an understanding and balance in Bible prophecy? How has the Church of God been able to maintain an understanding and balance of Bible prophecy? And I will hasten to add that sometimes it hasn't been all balanced, and sometimes not everyone in the church has been balanced about Bible prophecy. Someone expressed to me recently about Bible prophecy, "Steve, we've been saying these things for well over 50 years, meaning his experience in the church, my experience in the church. We've been talking about the return of Jesus Christ for 50 years. We've been talking about the end times for 50 years. Well, that's a correct statement. It's been going on for a lot longer than that as well. And it hints at a potential problem among Bible students who are serious about studying Bible prophecy that actually occurred over a century ago, well over a century ago. And there's obviously the potential to repeat history. Turn to Daniel chapter 8. Pardon me. Daniel 8 and verse 14. I'm lifting a passage out of the whole context of Daniel 8 to set the stage for a story. And this story I haven't told you before. And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." In 1844, a minister by the name of William Miller predicted that Jesus, well, actually prior to 1844, actually beginning in the 1830s, William Miller, who was a minister who had a following called Millerites, because they followed William Miller, predicted for about 9 years prior to 1844 that Jesus would return in 1844, specifically October 22nd, 1844. That did not happen, as you know. He based his prediction on this particular verse. He made a lot of mistakes in Bible prophecy, as you'll see. But in his study of Daniel 8, he became convinced that these 2,300 days into the future would be the time of Jesus' return. And he made a number of different mistakes. He calculated the time period of 2,300 days or 2,300 years. He used incorrectly a principle that we know from the book of Numbers called the day for a year principle that is used oftentimes in Bible prophecy. And he projected 2,300 years from 457 BC. And he came up to the dating period in an incorrect way of 1844. Made a lot of mistakes in his calculations. There is nothing to do with the time period of 457 BC in this particular prophecy. None whatsoever. There is something to do with it in the next chapter due to the dating of the Persian kings and so on and so forth, 457 BC. We've had articles about that in times past. He assigned the day for a year principle. That was a mistake. He calculated 2,300 years. But the meaning of this verse, as most of you know and have known for many, many years, isn't a matter of 2,300 days. It's 1,150 days of morning and evening sacrifices. And other translations bring that out. I'm not going to go into a detailed explanation of the 2,300 days prophecy here. Just suffice it to say that we know William Miller was wrong. The failed prophecy of 1844 is known as the Great Disappointment. A lot of people lost faith in Bible prophecy from that time period. Thousands of Miller's followers lost hope, and it might be argued, I'll argue it, it might be, so I will. It might be argued that this failed prophecy of Jesus' return threw a wet blanket on Bible prophecy for many decades afterwards. This William Miller was a preacher who had a lot of sway with a lot of people, and religion was pretty strong in our nation back in those years. And there was a Church of God back in those years. And I think that some people in the Church of God, what we would later come to call the Church of God Seventh Day, or they would come to call themselves, may have also been affected by this failed prophecy. The worldwide Church of God, at the time of my introduction to it, had its setbacks in terms of failed prophetic utterances as well. I remember sitting in church services in January 7th, 1972. I hadn't yet been baptized. I'd only been attending since November of the previous year. I'd had some contact at a church picnic in August of 1971, my first introduction to real church people. You were all very weird then, by the way. No, just joking. Very, very loving and friendly group. Was very, very impressed. But my first church service of January 1972, the minister got up and jokingly referred to all the charts and timetables that he had to destroy the previous evening because things didn't work out prophetically. In other words, things didn't happen on that weekend or January 7th the way some had thought they were going to happen. And I don't even know what he was talking about then, and I kind of don't know what he was referring to even still. But there was this thing, there was this booklet written called 1975 in Prophecy. And I had read it the summer before, and it had scared me so badly that I realized I needed to talk to a minister. And I'll elaborate just a bit in that. The worldwide Church of God, unlike the Millerite movement of 1844, recovered. And even though there was kind of the failed utterance or prognostication of 1975 or the feelings, the Church of God didn't cower and didn't back away from the preaching of Bible prophecy. Do you know why? Well, you'll see today, and that's part of the SPS, is how have we maintained an understanding and knowledge of Bible prophecy? Others, when they saw that their utterances failed and their beliefs failed, gave up completely on Bible prophecy. I think the errors in calculations, however they were, I mean, I was just new in 1971, 72, we moved forward. I went to Ambassador College. I moved through the 70s. Many of you did as well. And you realize that many of you were around during that time. And you realize that even though there may have been, okay, a little blip on the radar screen of understanding, we continued to preach about Bible prophecy. And Bible prophecy was still the providence, or the province, rather, of Worldwide Church of God, and it was at the center of its preaching, and it was kind of a hook that really intrigued a lot of people, as it did me. I think the errors in calculation are certainly understandable as you move into the 60s and the early 70s, when you see what was happening in our nation, things that had never happened before, and for those of us who grew up in the 40s and the 50s, we saw things happening and change happening in society that was unparalleled. We are seeing race riots in major cities in the 60s. We had the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and then it seemed as though things began to cascade very, very quickly after that period of time, and an escalation of the Vietnam War, which we couldn't seem to win. We couldn't seem to overcome, and it really seemed as though the pride of the power of the United States was being broken. So there was a pace of radical change. For those of you that weren't alive at that particular time, just take our word for it. The history books are probably not going to do it justice in helping you to see just how dramatic the flow in the change of society was during the time of the 60s. And then there were the hippies. Okay. It has nothing to do. It's kind of a non sequitur, but anyway. We have a lot of younger members in our audience who do not realize how traumatic these times were for those of us that came ahead of you by just a little bit. I grew up in small town America, where I could leave in the morning and get on my bike and be away all day and come home when the street lights came on for dinner and nobody raised an eyebrow. It wasn't unsafe. It was a good environment. And we did that a lot, and probably most every day of the summer, with our parents' great encouragement, get out of the house. That's the way life was. For many of us, it was a simpler time and a more peaceful time, although it was during the time of the Cold War as well. And the local JC group built a bomb shelter in one of the city parks just to show us all how it's to be done. It was just a concrete block box that was a few feet under the ground. And I'm sure that somebody somewhere along the way thought that you could survive an atomic blast, but you wouldn't have. But at any rate, that was the one thing that maybe was a harbinger of difficult times. For me, the calling of God helped me to understand the changes that were taking place in society at a rapid pace during those tumultuous years of which I speak. I want to talk about our advantage and why the Church of God has been able to maintain this understanding and fervent belief in Bible prophecy when other groups have had failed prophecies and it has set them back for many, many years, or led to a just total disbelief in the Bible being prophetic at all. I'm going to take you back to a time long before I was even born, but we have a written record of it. In 1937, Herbert Armstrong was invited to a conference in Detroit, Michigan, your hometown. Detroit. It was a meeting of the Church of God Seventh-day Elders, which they considered as a ministerial conference. They considered many items to review. That was the church that Herbert Armstrong and Loma Armstrong became acquainted with regarding the Sabbath, as you'll remember in reading the autobiography and hearing stories of the past in Eugene, Oregon, etc., etc. Eventually, Herbert Armstrong was ordained a minister and invited to this particular conference, and he wanted to submit two papers to that conference for their consideration. Turn to Genesis chapter 48. Genesis 48 and verse 16. This is the incidence in which Jacob, who several years earlier had had his name changed to Jacob, changed from Jacob, from supplanter to overcomer to one with God, etc., etc. There are several different meanings for the name Israel. Virtually on his deathbed, is taking the sons of Joseph as his own. And he's laying hands on them, and we know what this sacred purpose of this particular ceremony was, because it had been repeated from Abraham to Isaac and then to Jacob, and now from Jacob or Israel to the sons of Joseph, his next youngest son, Benjamin being the youngest. Joseph, we know what a job he did in the land of Egypt. We know how he was paramount, and we know in saving that nation. And at the end of his life, Jacob now lays hands on Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And it says in verse 15, and he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Bless the lads, Ephraim and Manasseh. Let my name, the name of Israel, be named on them. Now, there were 12 tribes of Israel that would become tribes. They weren't tribes yet, but there were 12 sons, right? And they would become 12 tribes. And they're all collectively known as Israel, the nation of Israel, and they came out of Egypt later on. You know all the story there, right? But Jacob, or Israel, said, let my name be specifically applied to these two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. Let my name be named upon them and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And then in the next chapter, Jacob utters a prophecy about all of his boys, but the specific blessings of national greatness and promise would go to these two, and they would be collectively known as Joseph. This is some of the information that Herbert Armstrong presented to the Church of God Seventh Day, we would call them Church of God Seventh Day, in 1937 in Detroit, Michigan. You can find the minutes of the meetings, for crying out loud, and read them for yourself to see what the decision was. But this book, the Holy Bible, is a book about Israel, about these two boys, about Jacob, Israel, Ephraim, and Manasseh, to a lesser extent, all the rest of the 12 tribes. Now, this of and by itself proves nothing, but you know I'm kind of a numbers guy. I like to cite numbers and statistics to you. But Israel is mentioned, and now not every case is going to be a prophetic or historic reference to the 12 tribes or Israel or Jacob, but it's interesting to note that 2,399 times in the New King James Version of the Bible, Israel is mentioned. Many of those things, many of those times are prophetic in the minor prophets, the major prophets, and in the Pentateuch and elsewhere. They're not just history. They're oftentimes references to a future occurrence or Bible prophecy. Other times it's just Israel and it, okay, so you get the point. Jacob is mentioned 359 times and oftentimes in the minor prophets and the major prophets, okay? Joseph is mentioned 240 times. Significant. Now, there are other Josephs other than the Joseph that we're speaking about in Genesis 48 and 49. I get it. I'm just citing, and I, you know, look, there's not enough sermon preparation time to go through and sort out every single instance in which Joseph does not refer to this particular Joseph that helped save Egypt. But you get the point. There are a few others. Ephraim is mentioned 169 times. Manasseh is referred to 139 times. When Israel is mentioned in a prophetic sense, it oftentimes refers to Ephraim and Manasseh. Sometimes it's labeled together as Jacob. Sometimes it's Joseph. Sometimes it's Israel. But you get the point. This book is a history book and a prophetic book of who and what Israel is. Not the little postage-sized stamp nation of modern-day Israel, where many Jews live, some Palestinians, etc., etc. But who are these people? The paper, one of them, that Herbert Armstrong presented for evaluation by other elders in 1937, had to do with this question. Who is Israel? The cynics would call it British Israelism, which is interesting that British Israelism as a theology came into being around the 1800s, long before America ever came into its fullness of its power as it did in the 20th century. So there was that knowledge that was there about who Israel was. And did Herbert Armstrong buy into it? Yep. Judah's birthright, Jacob's scepter, Judah's birthright. Yeah, that was one of the major works of the 19th century. These are the people of the Bible and of prophecy. That paper was rejected by the Church of God, Seventh Day. We do not hold to these things, they said. The paper is rejected. They did not accept it. The teachings of who Israel was, and then the other paper was a paper on the seven annual holy days. Guess what? Not a unanimous agreement among the elders of the Church of God Seventh Day that we should be keeping these holy days like Pentecost of last weekend. In fact, no one agreed with him. That paper was also rejected. Now, we read and we study of the early life of Herbert and Loma Armstrong and realize that they began understanding that those days should be kept just like the Sabbath. He saw in Leviticus 23, among other places, where the Sabbath and then all these other days are mentioned. Well, he got to thinking, we should keep those days too. And he did not understand exactly why too, and maybe didn't keep them all perfectly to begin with. But if you will go back, as I have, and retrace the co-worker letters of 1937 and 1938 and 1939, you begin to see a progressive development in the mind of Herbert Armstrong and the small flock of Radio Church of God, in which there was an association with Bible prophecy concerning these days. You came into the church, either Radio Church of God or Worldwide Church of God, where there was great acceptance of the holy days. And understanding the holy days gives us a glimpse back into Bible history and then a glimpse forward into the future Bible prophecy. The holy days outline the past, the present, and the future of God's plan. And if you don't keep those holy days, you really can't understand from the sense that you do what God is doing. Now, I know that that particular information, set of information, is not necessarily brand new, but the 1937 conference was actually the second time that the concept of who Israel was and the holy days was presented to the Church of God Seventh Day, because as Mr. Tannert helped make me aware of, a few years ago, there was another minister who was kind of independent from the Church of God Seventh Day, but he was a Sabbath-keeping minister, and he also had tumbled on to the idea of British Israelism, I guess you could say, or the identity of ancient Israel and the tribes of Israel. And he also kept the holy days with his small group in Oklahoma. His name was G.G. Rupert. And there's enough church history that has been preserved. And he died in the early 1920s. And for a while, that information that he had published in the flagship publication of the Church of God Seventh Day, the Bible Advocate, his information had been published by the editor, Andrew Duggar, and previously his father, A.F.N. Duggar, earlier. So they had had a double whammy in the 20th century of being presented with this information, but nobody else agreed with them. Didn't agree with G.G. Rupert. They didn't agree with Herbert Armstrong. In 1993, I attended a conference in Santa Barbara, California, in which the then, what do you call them, the administrators or the leaders of Worldwide Church of God, 7 years after the death of Herbert Armstrong, had decided that they would kind of try to patch up things with the Church of God Seventh Day, now headquartered and still headquartered, I believe, in Denver, Colorado. And they invited several of their leading ministers to our conference. Basically, I think it was kind of an apology tour to apologize. Oh, look how badly we've treated you, Church of God, Seventh-day people, all these years, and how badly Herbert Armstrong treated them. Because it was evident at lunch that day that even though they were kind of a generation removed from that experience, they rankled under the fact, if you'll turn to Revelation chapter 3, they were not happy. And that came out during lunch. They were not happy that Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God as a group had labeled them as the Sardis era. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 2, it says, "Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die, for I have not found your works perfect before God." Now, anybody that understands or reads about church eras, they want to be Philadelphia, right? I've said that before. Everybody wants to be known as a Philadelphian because they're filled with brotherly love, etc., etc. But these men were not happy with the church. And our leaders at that time, after Mr. Armstrong's death, were aware of the fact that they were upset that they had been called the Sardis era because the Sardis era is not perfect before God. So they were not happy about that. What are the things that are not perfect before God? So if you believe in church eras, I do, and not everybody does, I get it. What are the things that were not perfect before God? Dare I say it? Dare I speculate? I think, time will tell, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. I kind of think it was their rejection of the understanding of who Israel was presented to them 56 years earlier in a conference in Detroit, Michigan, and the understanding of the Holy Day Plan. It was there. It was presented. You had a chance. The Bible Advocate has published many good articles through the years, so don't get me wrong. I have respect for them. But they don't have a great belief in Bible prophecy. My life was changed by it. My life was changed by the understanding, fundamental to you right now, of everyone that's sitting here, that Jesus Christ will indeed return to this earth. Hal Lindsey had a little bit of that information, but mixed up on a lot of other things like the rapture and so on and so forth. But the Church of God was one organization that was preaching the validity of Bible prophecy and Jesus' return. I think maybe it's possible. I'm not going to be so dogmatic on this, but I'll just speculate. You know what I'm speculating. That maybe those were things that Jesus Christ knew in advance. God knows the end from the beginning. That they would not tumble onto. Now, I've done a series on the Bible church eras, on the church eras of Revelation 3, and there were many great ministers in the Sardis era from the time of the 1600s moving forward and the establishment of the Church of God in Rhode Island, or Sabbath keepers in Rhode Island, etc., etc. We know that. In lunch that day, I've told this story before. In lunch that day, sitting with Church of God Seventh-day ministers, and they're all very nice, one of our ministers asked them about their thoughts and attitudes toward Herbert Armstrong, and they kind of were dismissive. They were dismissive of everything that he had accomplished, and I was not happy with their response, but to my credit, I did not lift the table up and flip it up. I got up, got my napkin off my lap, and threw it down. No, I didn't. But I just simply said as I exited, yeah, it's kind of interesting that Herbert Armstrong built kind of a religious group and work and church which had the income of many hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And then I left. I stormed off. Well, anyway, I don't hold them accountable for that. I mean, you only can know what you know. But more importantly, the Holy Days and the understanding of who Israel is help the Church of God progress with the understanding of Bible prophecy and not diminish it. They weathered the storm of what was the result of some failed speculative dating, which some of you that have been around for a long time know did happen. It wasn't a big deal for me because I was just coming into the church, and like I said, it went over my head. Zoom! I didn't know what the minister on January 7, 1972 was referring to, so, you know, then I went off to college, and none of this problem that had happened that may have affected a few people affected me whatsoever. The Church of God survived because of the knowledge of Bible prophecy didn't rest on a certain date. It was founded on the pillars of the identity of Israel and the keeping of the holy days. And I maintain that without that knowledge, it's very difficult to maintain a balance and an understanding of Bible prophecy. The failure of the Miller-Wright prognostication may have affected the Seventh-day Adventist movement and some who may have been loosely affiliated with what we would look back and say was Church of God members of the 19th century, and apparently may have formed the later stage of what was called the Sardis era. I had a friend who I first met who came to our service one time in Hagerstown, Maryland, and he came down from Chambersburg, and he just said, "My name is so-and-so, and, you know, how long have you been around? How long have you been in the church?" He says, "Oh, my parents were in the Sardis church." So he openly acknowledged that. Now, not everybody would, but he made the migration from the Sardis church to what we all believed was the Philadelphian era. Turn to Revelation chapter 1. Revelation 1 and verse 2. Second verse, chapter 1, Revelation, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ to all the things that he saw. This particular phrase, testimony of Jesus Christ, is only found in the book of Revelation. Drop down to verse 9, it says, I, John, both your brother and companion in the tribulation and kingdom and patience of Jesus Christ, was on the island that is called Patmos for the word of God and for the testimony of Jesus Christ. The testimony of Jesus Christ then is linked to that revelation that an angel gave to the apostle John. Now in Revelation chapter 12, a chapter that we believe applies to the church of God, it says in Revelation 12 in verse 17, and I won't read all the previous scriptures which allude to the attack on the woman or church by the devil. But it says, the dragon was enraged with the woman, that is the church, the people of God. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. This persecuted church of the end time keep the commandments and have Jesus' testimony. The phrase testimony of Jesus is only mentioned four times in this book. We've read three of them. And the last reference helps further the explanation of Jesus' testimony and that it is his preaching, his teaching, and especially this prophetic book. Turn ahead to Revelation 19 and verse 10. Revelation 19 and verse 10, John now encounters another angel. He says, and I fell at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, see that you do not do that. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy. The testimony is also the revelation of Jesus Christ of the future. It is good to understand Bible prophecy in balance. It is good to know the plan of God, which the Holy Days helps us to understand, to know to whom the Bible is addressed specifically, because if we do agree that the Bible is a quarter or a third, I tend to think that it might be even much greater than that, filled with Bible prophecy, then it behooves us to know who it is that is being addressed. Who are the major subjects? Because it certainly isn't a lot of other nations in the world. It's got to be a few. A few to whom God promised certain things. It behooves individuals who want to understand Bible prophecy to understand to whom the Bible is addressed and who those people have been down through history and in the Bible as well, so that we can help identify the outcome of the inspired words of God. We read just a bit ago Revelation 12, and it indicates that the protection of a portion of God's people, his church, who are protected from the serpent. Turn back to Revelation 3. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell in the earth. Is Revelation 12 a promise as well to this particular group of people? People who have the spirit of prophecy, people who have the testimony of Jesus Christ? I tend to think so, but I'll leave that up to you. In verse 7, it says, to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. It is a church of brotherly love. And brotherly love wants to share what it has with others. And we, in times past, always associated this particular verse with an open door to preach the gospel. I don't know if that's the only meaning of the verse, but I do know this, that if it hadn't been that church that came into my life in 1971, I would have no understanding of Bible prophecy. And it came to me because there were people who were willing to share that information and that knowledge. And it's a group of people that did something very substantial, preaching the kingdom of the gospel of God and all that that entails, and the reason that we understand it so well, and you do understand it very well. I submit to you that the reason that you do is because you keep those days that are holy to God, and that you do know to whom the Bible is addressed, both historically and prophetically. The great disappointment of 1844 led to a precipitous decline in the understanding of Bible prophecy, even among the people who were called by the name Church of God. But it was revived through the Church of God, and we can understand Bible prophecy with balance because we know who the subjects of the Bible are, and we are led by the understanding of God's holy day plan.